BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
We rather pride ourselves on the Political Thinking podcast that people appear, they have a conversation, and days, weeks later, they get promoted. But there is always an exception that proves the rule.
Well, Nick, this is going to be the only interesting thing on my obituary that's going to be written. Tarantula ownership.
That, of course, was the former Defence Secretary. Now, Gavin Williamson doesn't need an obituary. He hasn't died, though perhaps his political career is now dead. When I talked to him just a few weeks ago, I asked him about that pet spider, the one he used to have on his desk when he was Chief Whip, the one that was used to intimidate Tory MPs. I asked him if he could confirm the tarantula's name.
Cronus.
After?
The Greek god.
Who?
Who usurped his father and ate his children. But I don't want you to...
I was wondering that you'd forgotten then, Rick. I was just wondering whether to say it. Gavin Williamson was perhaps a little too unaware of what he should and what he shouldn't be saying. It didn't take a Hercule Poirot to work out that he was at least the main suspect within seconds of that leaked story about the cabinet row about Huawei make it to the front page of The Telegraph. Mr. Williamson, as you'll know, has strenuously denied that he was the leaker. Not only that, he's done so swearing on the lives of his children. I wonder what they make of that. However, he has admitted speaking to the journalist who wrote the story, Steve Swinford. He has admitted he did so after a meeting of the National Security Council. He has admitted that the conversation lasted 11 minutes. Though, I'm told, he says, they weren't talking about what happened at that meeting. This is, in effect, like being in the library, standing over a dead body, holding the lead piping, and when caught, insisting that you're just doing it to exercise your biceps. The truth is, the former Defence Secretary may not have been the briefer of the story. He may not have been the only briefer of the story, as virtually every member of the Cabinet seems keen to talk to journalists these days. But as well as having form a track record of approaching many subjects with an open mouth, at least in private, he also had motive. He did, as he explained on the podcast, believe it was his duty to alert the public to the threat coming from China and from Russia.
Our adversaries have been investing in new technology, and of course the technology that they're investing in is vastly more expensive than what non-state-based actors can do. And there's been a realisation, it's not just with the UK, it's also in the US, it's also in France and Germany and all NATO allies, that there has been this re-emergence of a new threat. We have to talk about it, because if we don't talk about it, I think that the British people will be blind to it.
Well, the British people are certainly not blind to the debate about what is and isn't in our national interests. Mr. Williamson's lost his job, though. Not because he alerted the public to the risks posed by China, but because the Prime Minister and the Cabinet Secretary were not blind to what he'd been doing in private, boasting that he'd made Theresa May and could now break her, complaining that the priorities of the two people thought to be really running the government were wrong when it came to defence. If he didn't get more money for his department, he would bring the Prime Minister down. One minister remarked this week that Theresa May was appalled to her core at the way he'd been persuading. She's a person deeply uncomfortable in the company of journalists who loathes gossip. He loves nothing more than to have a drink and a natter with my colleagues in the parliamentary lobby. The divide that had emerged between Theresa May and the man who helped her get into Number 10 and was her first Chief Whip, was on display, though we didn't know it then, at the Parliamentary Liaison Committee, when the Prime Minister sounded rather cheerful as she answered a question about whether she'd promote more women
to senior jobs?
Well, as you might have noticed, I do like it when women are in senior positions. I think that women should be encouraged to apply for senior positions.
She knew, but we didn't. She'd already decided to sack Williamson and appoint a woman, Penny Mordaunt, in his place. Now, the good news for Penny Mordaunt is good news for my guest on the podcast this week. Rory Stewart replaces her as Secretary of State in the Department for International Development. Rory Stewart spent the last few months touring the studios, promoting the Prime Minister's Brexit deal, as once he used to tour the world, walking through Afghanistan, helping to govern two provinces in Iraq, and as a diplomat in Montenegro. We recorded this conversation on the day after Rory Stewart's promotion to the cabinet, and in the hours before we heard the results of the local elections. Rory Stewart, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
Day one in the cabinet. How different does it feel?
Well, it feels very, very different. I was called into number 10 yesterday to see the Prime Minister, and it was a familiar conversation because I've had, I think now, five different jobs in government. But this is the first time that I've been in the cabinet. Really wonderful. I mean, wonderful for me, wonderful for my mother, and also to return to a department where I was a junior minister and to see so many faces that I knew. And people, actually, because I started working in the government in 1991, which is quite a long time ago, an enormous number of people that I knew from before I became a politician.
Working in, yes, not as a politician, but as a diplomat in the Foreign Office. And when you say wonderful for your mother, was she the first person you called?
First person I called was my wife, and the second person
probably was diplomatic.
Second person I called was my mother.
Yeah, and because you're from a family that's been in a form of government service for a very long time, does this feel like it was always going to happen?
Oddly, for me or for my father or our whole tradition, it's always been anti-politician. Yes, I've been in government, but I was very briefly in the army, and then I was in the Foreign Office. And for me and for my father, we were always a little suspicious, I think, of MPs. My father particularly so. He was in the army, and then he was a colonial civil servant in Malaya after the war, and then he was a spy. And for him, politicians were people who did a lot of talking and pushing bits of paper around. And so he was always very sceptical when I said I wanted to be a politician. He died very sadly 3 years ago, but I'm sure because he was a wonderful enthusiast for his son and very supportive of everything I did, he would have made nice noises. But I slightly wonder what in the back of his mind he really would have thought about becoming a cabinet minister.
You think he would in some ways, and when you say he was a spy in Hong Kong, but he went on to be number two in MI6. Do you think he would have had a little sense of he's gone to the dark side?
Yes, I think he would have felt that, like him, I was somebody who liked getting things done, and he was always a bit suspicious about whether ministers actually ever got anything done.
Now, lots of people knew you long before you were a politician because of your writing and your walking and your writing about walking. And it was your father that I've seen you say taught you to walk. What did you mean by taught you to walk?
Well, he took me on long walks. I mean, he was a Highland Scot of a very eccentric, exaggerated sort. He wore tartan all the time. Even in Vietnam, he'd wander around in tartan trousers. He made me take up the bagpipes when I was quite young. He taught me to sword dance when I was four. And one of the things that for him was important about being Highland Scot was walking in the Highlands. So we spent an enormous amount of time trudging up and down rainy Perthshire rivers. And then out when he was posted to Malaysia into the Malayan jungle, where he'd take me as a six-year-old and build rafts, and we'd sail down jungle rivers with bacon and egg sandwiches, which was a strange choice, I now realise, in a Muslim country.
But taught to walk in the sense of how to pace yourself, how to enjoy it, how to look out at the world around you.
Absolutely, and above all, for him, how to deal with people. So his whole life, he spent nearly 50 years in Asia working in Malaysia and the Philippines and Burma, in Hong Kong and China itself. And what I really learned from him was his extraordinary ability to be able to reach out to somebody in a Thai village and engage them in conversation. He had these tricks that he was obsessed with. So, for example, when he was speaking Chinese, he would always begin with a particular phrase, which meant, excuse me, in order to try to get people to understand that he was speaking Chinese. Otherwise, his complaint was they'd flicked an idiot switch and they'd think, here's this Englishman talking at me. I wonder what on earth he's talking about.
So what's your technique now? Because, I mean, just to tell people who don't know, the walk you wrote about, you travelled, what, 6,000 miles?
I walked 6,000 miles. I walked
across
from Turkey, across Iran, Afghanistan, Pakistan, India, Nepal. I walked 20, 25 miles a day. I spent every night in a different village house, sleeping on people's floors, talking to them about their sense of government and society. And I think for me, probably the most lasting memories from that walk was not what I expected. I expected I'd be able to remember 6,000 miles worth of footprints behind me. But what really stuck with me were those people, those 550 nights in the houses, and understanding the gap between the way that an Afghan talked about their own life and the way that foreigners, diplomats, soldiers talked about Afghanistan and the capital.
And you really did talk to them about government, because you weren't in government. You didn't at that stage know you were going to be a politician, I think, did you? So it doesn't strike me as a natural subject to stay in someone's house, well, arrive and say you're on a walk. Say, what do you think of the governance of your country?
Well, remember, when I went on the walk, I'd been, by that stage, a diplomat for... So I'd been working in the embassy in Indonesia. I'd been working in Montenegro after the Kosovo War. So I was very, very interested in this question of how you rebuild states after conflict, which is really what had been going on with Bosnia and Kosovo. And so when I was walking across countries like Afghanistan, my real question, because I'd entered just after the Taliban government had fallen and a new government was being created, is what the relationship was between the person that could be shooting at me or the donkeys that I just came across laden with drugs on their way to the market, on the one hand, and on the other hand, what it felt like to sit in the capital in Kabul, where I saw, of course, all my ex-colleagues, because I was actually just on leave from the Foreign Office doing this walk. So I went straight back into the embassy in Kabul and suddenly found myself in a room with the Afghan president and, for some extraordinary reason, Bianca Jagger. And they were all saying, there's a commitment to an Afghan society to a gender-sensitive, multi-ethnic, centralized state based on democracy, human rights, and rule of law. And I thought, how do I translate that into language that anyone in a village could understand?
You're constantly irritated, aren't you, by that? The buzzwords of politics, words like governance and accountability. And is that something you've taken into government as a minister and will now apply as a cabinet minister?
Absolutely. I mean, the first meeting that I did almost today in DFID was about this subject, which was to say we were looking at South Sudan and to say, I don't want to see a document like this where the word governance appears 161 times, but the names of the South Sudanese people, Dinka, Nua, don't appear. Or the word church only appears once in a 400-page document, but it's the Catholic Church that's actually delivering the healthcare and the education in Equatorial and South Sudan. So I think everything begins with honest language, because it's only if you learn to speak about, and not just honest, but particular, specific, this place, this person. I felt this in prisons, that the key point is not to say what matters in prisons is relationships. That doesn't mean anything to a prison officer. What you should be saying is, I want you to sit down for 45 minutes once a week in this cell, and these are the subjects that you might want to talk to a prisoner about. That's useful. The word relationships is not useful.
Why? Why doesn't it happen? Why do you think Whitehall is addicted to language that confuses rather than clarifies?
I think that the first reason is that it's deeply comforting. Many of these words sound very pious, very good. I mean, who could be against transparency? Who could be against accountability? Secondly, because they're wonderfully vague, they can be applied to almost anything. So a word like sustainability, you can pop up in a meeting and nobody knows whether you're talking about environmental sustainability, in other words, you're saying this thing emits too much carbon, or financial sustainability, you're about to run out of cash, you can just throw out the word. And it doesn't require you to know anything about this place, this person. In fact, it's quite comforting. If the conversation about South Sudan is, what do the Nua or the Luo clan of the Nua think about their oxen, that's a much more difficult conversation. But if the civil servant can talk generally about a zero-tolerance attitude to corruption, then they don't necessarily have to engage with that specific problem.
Now, one of the curiosities of our system is, you know, one minute you're the prisons minister, the next minute you are in charge of international development,
And you had within hours to do your first parliamentary statement.
Yes.
You've just done it.
Absolutely. And I think I...
You had how long to prepare?
I think I had about 26 minutes to try to get my thoughts together, to hit the dispatch box and deliver a speech without notes on international immunisation challenges.
But in a sense, because you'd been a defence minister before, because you've been a diplomat, because you've travelled a lot, does this feel like going home?
Yes, I mean, it's also true that although I obviously am in a raging campaign against the idea that there can be sort of universal amateur experts, it is true that I do learn a little bit from all these different jobs. I began as I was chair of the Defence Committee, then I was an environment minister, and then I went through these different DFID jobs, then I was a Foreign Office minister, then I was a prisons minister, and now I'm back again. I may not, obviously, in the end, know a great deal in depth about the outside world, but what I do know quite a lot about now is the way that government and civil service works, going all the way back through my career. And I can, I hope, bring to the party some sense of how you get things done, what's not worth trying, what sounds good but is going to fail, and a little bit about how to be quick and effective.
Are you conscious, as you say that, that in one sense it's a very modern CV, in another sense your CV reads like that of a Victorian colonial administrator? Eton, Blackwatch, tutor to the royal princes, Oxford, Montenegro, two Iraqi provinces being governed, adventures in Afghanistan. I feel like I've gone back 150 years.
Yes, I can see why you think that, absolutely. I also think, though, that one of the reasons I love being a Conservative is so much of my identity is about that. It's about tradition, it's about love of institutions, the monarchy, the army, the Foreign Office, and indeed, I read a lot of history. But I think that sense of tradition, that sense of love of those things goes along with my enthusiasm to deal with issues like climate change, or my desire to try to sort out, in a practical sense, a problem around housing, or get super-fast broadband on the ground. I spent a lot of my first 2-3 years of my job as a constituency MP working on super-fast broadband and mobile coverage.
Because you represent rural Cumbria.
Because I represent rural Cumbria. So I think the trick, or trick, the joy of being a Conservative is the joy of being able to combine tradition and romance with gritty, pragmatic action.
I'm intrigued to hear you talk about the joy of being a Conservative, because you weren't always a Conservative, were you?
Absolutely. And I learnt, I was a member of the Labour Party when I was a student, when I was 18.
And so who was leading Labour then?
God, blimey, I mean, we're going really back in the times. We're back in the early 90s, so that's I suppose, Kinnock.
Yeah.
And for me, the real discovery was that I felt, particularly looking at Tony Blair and dealing with, because I was working for him in Iraq and Afghanistan, or certainly in Iraq, that the amazing gap between the rhetoric and the reality on the ground, what made me a Conservative is the sense that these people were talking too much in grand abstractions. They had a highly centralized view of the world. They would lay out these grand policy ambitions and they weren't really engaging with how do we get this done.
Yeah, you'll know there'll be Conservatives listening. Many of them think he wasn't a Conservative. When Margaret Thatcher was opposing Neil Kinnock, he was backing Neil Kinnock.
I think,
now, how so?
Well, I imagine some people listening may also remember themselves at 18. Some of them may have been Conservatives, some of them may have children who are even more radical than I am. So I think, unfortunately, 18-year-olds have funny views of the world.
Were you angry with her? Were you opposed to her?
No, I think I'd come, I was actually largely coming into the beginning of the Major era, and I think I was, I'm afraid, although I, you know, I like John Major, I wasn't awfully excited by him.
Now, the person who did seem to excite you is David Cameron, because you saw an advert, am I right? You didn't have a political career. You saw a sort of wanted, unusual political candidate.
Yes, I was just finished in Afghanistan. And David Cameron said after the expenses scandal, he was looking for people who hadn't been involved in politics before to come forward to be MPs. And I thought, OK, I'll do this. But it was a strange thing to do. And as I say, my father was pretty suspicious about what I was doing. A lot of my friends thought I was off my trolley. I understand why on earth anyone would want to be an MP. I was actually in the United States at the time, and that was a really revealed a lot, actually, about the difference between American and British politics. Everybody in Britain said, why on earth would you want to be an MP? Nobody in the United States would say, why would you want to be a US senator? Self-evident why you'd want to be a US senator. And I think there is something there which is quite an important message, which is part of the objective for Britain is about regaining a sense of seriousness, taking ourselves seriously. And part of taking ourselves seriously has to be getting to a stage where nobody says, why would you want to be an MP?
I suspect they say it even more now to you, don't they? Given the divisions in your own party, in the government, in the country, given, frankly, the low status many members of Parliament have in the eyes of the public, are there moments when you go home after a long series of votes and think, why the hell? You know, I could be walking again, I could be writing again, I could be trying to make life better in places that really deserve it again.
Yeah, definitely, I sometimes feel like that. And then I have very happy moments. I loved, actually, probably the best job I've done in government was this last job I've just done in prisons, where I really felt I could see what I was doing, particularly focused on violence and drugs in prisons. And I could see that I was getting the sniffer dogs in, that we were fixing the windows, that we were clearing up the rubbish. But above all, the thing that mattered to me most, which is engaging with prison officers and seeing that these were the most extraordinary people. And if I hadn't been lucky enough to be a member of Parliament, I had never met these people. Never have had the privilege of going in and out of these prisons and seeing that these people are simultaneously teachers, policemen, psychologists, counsellors in a very violent environment and try and turn that around.
Now, in that job, you completely broke the rules of my business, which is someone, I think, put it to you that you might want to resign if you didn't get everything right. And to everyone's amazement, you say, oh, no, yeah, I will resign. I'm perfectly happy to resign. In fact, I'll give you a timescale. I'll resign within a year. Now, you've just dodged the year. Or do you think you would have survived?
I said that I would reduce violence, and people said, how quickly? And I said I'd do it within a year. And I'm very pleased that actually we succeeded in showing in our statistics published last week that we'd reduce violence by 14% in these prisons that I chose. So that was great. I think it's also important to understand that nobody should be complacent in this business and that there's a lot more work to be done in prisons. But I was pleased that I was at least able to achieve what I'd promised.
Now, back to DFID as Secretary of State. A department where you might have a target that would make you resign. What would make you resign as Secretary of State for International Development? What failure would be necessary?
My great mission with DFID has to be to get the delivery right on the ground. Get that, and this comes back to my fundamental principles. We are engaged with some of the greatest issues in the world. So we are the leading element of trying to deal with climate change because, of course, this climate emergency is not primarily driven from Britain. It happens overseas. And working with DFID is the best way that Britain has of engaging with problems, whether it's generation in China or whether it's the impact felt in Africa. Again, on immunization, we're lucky enough to be leading the world in eradicating polio. But the key point is getting that those noble objectives, the good intentions tied with really making sure that this is working and that when you turn up on the ground and see one of our projects, you feel proud to be British. You feel, I would be proud to put my brother into that clinic, into that school. Because the only way we're going to actually, you know, to be really pompous, save the planet or deal with climate change is if we're very, very careful about how we spend our money.
But if this Prime Minister, or indeed a future Prime Minister, said, we can't afford this target anymore, this 0.7%, we've got to spend the money at home or spend it better, is that a resigning issue?
I would fight hard against that because 0.7%, it's not 7% of your GDP, it's 0.7%. And when you look at the problem, let's just take this issue of climate change. When you look at the fact that the ice shelf is now 10 times smaller than we predicted, that we're about to lose 40% of the species on Earth by 2050, before you count the costs on humans. This is a very smart thing to do. It's a smart thing to do for the planet, but because we all breathe the same air, it's a smart thing to do for Britain. So it would be foolish, and it would also be foolish in a post-Brexit world for Britain to pull in its horns, disengage from the world. The one thing I would say, though, is to get the most out of that money, you've also got to spend some other types of money, defence money, foreign office money, to make sure that you can leverage the best benefit.
And yet some of your fellow ministers around the cabinet table will say the opposite to you. They'll say, I'd like some of Rory Stewart's DFID money to pay for my priorities. And we just rebadge aid. We can spend it on defence. We can send it on rebuilding some richer countries that we feel responsibility to because they're in the Commonwealth and they sometimes suffer. Are you going to try and say, no, no, this is DFID money and that's where it goes?
I'm a pragmatist. I'm not a purist. The argument I'm making is that it's hugely important that Britain plays a very active role in the world and that issues such as climate change or immunisation are fundamentally issues which should be driven by DFID. But of course, it makes sense for the Foreign Office to be doing some of this, for defence to be doing some of this, for trade, for goodness sake, to be doing some of this. And some of the most interesting projects we have in the world are when all these things come together. So take Jordan, right? Jordan, you can make the argument that we've got a great relationship with the King of Jordan. We can provide really interesting engagements for British businesses in Jordan around IT. But we also have 1 million Syrian refugees in Jordan who we have to look after in refugee camps. And we have a threat from Bashar al-Assad and ISIS and Islamist groups. So there's a defense element along the Jordanese border. If you can get all these things together and think about that sweet spot, a country of about that size where Britain has a range of different interests, my goodness, we could transform our reputation in the world.
Now, before any of that might get noticed, you've got to resolve the small matter of Brexit. Was it a self-conscious decision of yours to become the public face of the Prime Minister's deal? You will have been told, if not 100 times, 1,000 times, that you sell her deal rather better than she does.
Well, firstly, I don't agree with that. I'm a huge admirer of her, and I think history will judge her much more kindly than we're currently judging her. I think she's showing a degree of toughness, which is extraordinary. On the question of whether I chose to, I didn't at all. I was completely accidental. I just happened to believe, again, that when people look back in 40 years' time, they will realise that the solution to this problem has to be a Brexit deal, that trying to remain in the European Union is going to go wrong. It goes wrong politically, but I also think if you think it through from Europe's point of view, it's like spending 3 years getting divorced and then saying, oh, it turned out to be too expensive, I'm moving back into the bed, and then trying to get involved and talking about the EU army or the budget. It's not going to end well.
But the alternative, of course, many of your own constituents no doubt say to you and in your own constituency party, just get out, in inverted commas.
That would be very unnecessary and very damaging. And people who are pushing for that have to understand that no deal is not a destination. When you go into a no deal situation, you would still have to make a future deal with the EU, a future deal with the United States, and you'd be doing it from a weaker economic position. It's not necessary. We need to be patient. A good deal in place. And the main reason for that is that this isn't a deal for this year. It's a deal for the next 30 years. So let's get it right.
Now, you get pretty impatient, don't you, with people who say, why don't we just believe in Britain? That's the thing to do instead of surrendering or crawling on our knees, as Sir Bill Cash put it the other day. And you made a parallel with the bin bags during the winter of discontent. Tell me that story. I was intrigued because you took on Dominic Raab in a debate.
I'm not sure my analogy works very well, but what I was saying is that you have to think practically. In a sense, and this is where I think Mrs. Thatcher was right, there are similarities between a nation and a household, and it's worth thinking about a nation as a household and think about what makes sense to say. So if you were to say, for example, to your wife or your partner, I'm going to take 7 enormous filled bin bags and I'm going to cram them into the rubbish bin, she or he would say, it's not going to work, right? At which point it doesn't make much sense to say, believe in the bin bag, right? And we see this in our normal lives. But when it comes to the country, if I say, wait a sec, what you're about to do is going to be absolutely devastating for my Cumbrian dairy farmer. The milk price is going to go to this. This is what's going to happen to the cheese. To say, oh, don't be downhearted, believe in Britain, is no kind of answer. It's not an answer in a company, it's not an answer in a family, and it's not an answer in a nation. True patriotism, true optimism is based on reality. It's based on loving who we are at the moment and having an affectionate, realistic sense of who we can be in the future. What worries me about some of the talk around this is that it feels like pantomime. It's not realistic about who we actually are. It's probably not even very affectionate about who we are, and that my fear is that what sounds optimistic is actually a form of pessimism. They don't really believe they're going to be able to achieve any of these things. to really believe it, they would have to know what the steps are from A to B. And unless you can face reality relentlessly, it makes no sense to be hopeful.
Now, your phone is ringing. I'm worried it's number 10. Do you want to just answer it?
It'd be great to answer on your yeah. podcast.
But, well, particularly if you say Theresa, I'm busy.
Turns out to be the Daily Mail editor.
Oh, the editor of the Daily Mail. Well, I feel honoured that we're putting him on hold. Can he wait 10 minutes?
I can definitely wait.
Well, very good. I'm intrigued. But these days, of course, the editor of the Daily Mail is rather helpful to the government when it comes to Brexit, unlike many of your own backbenchers and indeed not a few of your current cabinet colleagues who will be debating now whether, and you'll be involved in these debates for the first time, whether it is acceptable to hold your nose and to walk into the same lobbies as Jeremy Corbyn and do a deal with the Labour Party to get a Brexit deal agreed.
Well, let's take it back and work backwards. We need a Brexit deal. No deal would be completely unnecessary and damaging. Staying in the European Union would be a cataclysm of a different sort. We need a Brexit deal done. We are not getting the votes on the Conservative side. We have to get it through the House of Commons. Where are those votes? We're going to have to reach to Labour. I wish, Prime Minister wishes, that we'd been able to do it with our Conservative colleagues. We've tried. We've banged our head against it. We've done all we can, month after month after month. But everybody can see, the public can see, everybody can see we can't do it. And there is an advantage of doing it cross-party. And the advantage is this. Because this is not just meant to be a deal for this year, but for the next 30 or 40 years, the risk of just doing it with one party is if general election happens, another party comes, and the whole thing gets unpicked again. Doing it as a national project together reflects the fact that an enormous number of Labour voters voted for Brexit, and indeed 4 million Tory voters voted Remain. And part of this project has to be a project of healing the country, bringing it back together again.
Couldn't you? Shouldn't you make that argument about all sorts of subjects, not just Brexit? You could argue about climate change. You could argue about renewing the housing stock, dealing with the prisons. Maybe the tribal, the party-driven approach to politics is the wrong one.
Some things you could make that argument for. I think you would be right to make that argument around climate change. I don't think that's something that should be party political. Other things, a vigorous debate, vigorous challenge is very good. Americans have got this terrible phrase, red teaming. One of the things the House of Commons does is it forces you to defend your position. So I was up there today at the dispatch box. My Labour opponent was putting in some very hard questions about why are you not working in middle-income countries, when it comes to vaccination, why are you working with the private sector, forcing me to defend myself. That party system is good, and I think it's good that the public gets to choose. And I think it's actually probably, in the end, reassuring for people, they can see quite clearly that Jeremy Corbyn has a completely different view of the world, a view of the world I totally disagree with, and have a choice between different things. They know what they're getting.
But wouldn't your father have said, if he was still here, my late father would have said, well, he's just pulled together for the sake of the country, this artificial partisan divide, childish point scoring in the House of Commons. Shouldn't Rory Stewart, the former diplomat, the former military officer, say, just let's do what's right. Stop faffing about with the politics.
I think my father definitely would have said, had the two instincts that we all have. One of them is, yeah, Brexit, of course, is a national issue. Let's get it done. Let's work together. And secondly, let's be very careful of the idea of Jeremy Corbyn.
Now, you unusually, and it's very unusual for journalists dealing with this question, are open about wanting to lead the country. Normally, we have to go through this great sort of dance to persuade politicians. Why have you broken the taboo by saying, yeah, I quite fancy being Prime Minister?
I think for a couple of reasons. Firstly, I think it's important at this time when the Prime Minister said that she's going to step down to have a voice that's arguing for being radical, but radical in the centre of British politics, not radical on the extreme right of British politics. A voice that's prepared to say, I do want to bring this country together. That of course I accept Brexit, I'm a Brexiteer, but I want to reach out to Remain voters as well, and that we have to bring this country together again. And the only way I can do that is by moving beyond my brief and beginning to lay out, whether it's on climate change or any of these other issues, what I think it would mean to be a country that we could be proud of.
And you will do that now you're in the cabinet, not just dealing with your brief, you'll go wider.
I have to get the balance right on this because my primary job is to look after my department, and that's what I really want to focus on full-time, day in, day out. But ultimately, the Prime Minister has said that she's going to step down, and I think if we're going to have a leadership contest, we might as well be open about it, and candidates might as well explain what they're about.
You told The Spectator a while ago, if you want someone who really enjoys doing stuff and loves government and is really proud of the country and feels that's their thing, I'm really enthusiastic. That phrase, feels that it's their thing, it made me think, is this the old Etonian view that, yeah, I can turn my hand to anything? We chaps, we can get it done. Or maybe that's just my northern chippiness coming out.
Look, I mean, I completely understand all that feeling. And I think people should be very careful and very modest about how they talk about running a country. The reality is that a country is far bigger than any human brain. For goodness sake, London is bigger than any human brain can possibly encompass. We've got tens of millions of people with very different views and identities and skills, many of whom will be much smarter than me. I think the only thing that I'm saying there is that I've been lucky enough to have a life where I've had a chance to do things. I like, particularly, I suppose, I like operational things. I like delivering things. I like getting things done quickly. And it's not a very popular story, but I think one of the things that is important in government is getting government better at doing things quickly and well. Showing huge respect for civil servants, rebuilding their morale. I think we need to invest more in public services. I think austerity has ended and we need to go into a new world of public investment. But I think as that happens, we really need to up our game, and we need to get to a stage where the basic test is pride and dignity. And that means when you look at a British prison or a British school, do you feel, my goodness, this is a great institution? I'd invite anyone from anywhere in the world to look at this thing. And secondly, would I put my mother in that institution? Would I be proud for my sister to be there?
Now, you say you want to restore the pride of civil servants. One of the reasons you're here today, one of the reasons you're in the cabinet, is because Gavin Williamson fell out with the top civil servant in the land, with the cabinet secretary. He's now saying he's massively comfortable with the idea of a police inquiry into whether he leaked. Do you think, in a way, it may be the only way to clear this up?
I don't want to comment on that kind of thing. I mean, I think there's a difference between a police inquiry and what happens at the National Security Council. But I think the other thing is that this leak and the whole origin of the story comes out of the people gossiping about the National Security Council. So I don't want to join the game of gossiping about the National Security Council. I would say that Gavin was an extremely energetic Secretary of State for Defence, and whatever happened in those last days, whatever he did wrong at the end, we owe him huge respect for what he did before that.
You've said you're happiest walking. You once said your address should be a hedge, but you're now preparing for an address that might one day be Downing Street.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting sort of analogy, isn't it? You sort of have an impression of a kind of tramp camping out on the front of that polished black door. I believe that walking isn't just putting one foot in front of another. It's a way of being in the world. It's about literally getting your feet dirty. It's about moving slowly and patiently, but above all, it's about being on the ground. So in that funny combination that we all get when we walk, between, I suppose, pompously, the empirical, you know, the practical, my blister hurts, my boot's too tight, where am I going to sleep for the night, and the romantic, the lifting your eyes, your mind suddenly calming down, seeing the landscape opening up in front of you, is what gives me joy in this country and what gives me joy in being a Conservative.
Rory Stewart, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
I'm still recovering from the shock of asking a man whether he wants to run for Prime Minister of this country and him explicitly saying yes on his first day in the cabinet when there is no vacancy. It all fits in with something I read that Rory Stewart had said, that what people want is someone who's thinking as they speak rather than someone who's already thought it through and is simply banging it out, as he put it. There is a sense, as you talk to him, that he's thinking about the answers, quite often closes his eyes as he speaks, as he formulates the words. What you don't get is the sense of a man with a line to take that he's just pumping out. That's it from Political Thinking for this week. The producer is Peter Snowden. The editor is Martin Rosenbaum. And this week's studio manager is Ash Taylor. Oh, sorry, I just got to take this a second. Hello, Geordie. No, I can't write for the mail tomorrow, Geordie. I'm sorry, I'm busy. Ask Rory, for goodness sake. That do?
Yeah.
Oi, you. While you're here, have a listen to this, would you?
Forest.
An environmental thriller for BBC Sounds.
I'm so sorry.
Meet Pan.
Oh, I did.
She lives a few centuries from now, after a data crash that wiped out most records of life.
Shunk.
So when she finds an old recording of a rainforest, she has no idea what it is.
Forest 404. Nine-part thriller, nine-part talk, nine-part soundscape.
Starring Pearl Mackie, Tanya Moody and Pippa Hayward, with theme music by Bonobo.
Subscribe now on BBC Sounds.
Subscribe now.